It's a forum about stories that rise from communities. So our hope tonight is not to describe communities, but to tell stories that would help others enter into an experience of community that we have had. And we've invited Rick Teagle to tell a story he wrote while he was at Holden. And we have invited Musimbi to tell a story from community, and I have a story to tell as well. And after we've told ours, our hope is that an inspiration might fall upon you, and you who are gathered would also have a story to tell that would draw us deeply into what community is and what it means and how we live. So, Rick appears to be most prepared with the manuscript and all. Would you mind going first?
I'll go first.
This is Rick Teagle, lead cook.
And Chris?
Let's introduce all of us first.
I'm Chris Kleinke. I'm a short-term staff here.
Mohongi Kanyo, from Kenya.
I'm Evelyn Hedman, a guest.
I'm Myron Sandberg, a guest.
I'm Marva Dunn.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Susan.
I'm Cindy Cagnaro, a guest.
Thanks.
Okay.
In a place wild and raw, before there were CDs and TVs, and before there was roads and cars, and before there was war, and before there was peace, there lived creatures living in the cradle of creation, living in the promise that all is provided for, even for the fragile flowers of the waters. They were the parents of today's yesterday, and before that, they were the parents of all creation. And like us, they had daily struggles and joys, and like us, they had days of celebration. And it was on one such celebration that all of this occurred. It began with the long-eared ones, and it moved through the jumping ones, and into the long-legged ones, and into the swimming ones, and it caught the two-legged, and the hooved, and the flying ones. In fact, it caught all the parents of creation. A whisper, that's what it was. The long-eared ones had heard it from the wind. There was going to be a huge storm, one of great cold and great strength. Would likely kill many of the creatures. Many were fearful, and they argued over food and of space, of warmth. And there was a storm, and winding, and raining, chaos. And the wind would have been right had it not been for the mouse and the silence. There was an earth-shattering crash, and then silence, and the mouse spoke. It doesn't have to be this way, and at the risk of being the target of all the chaos, this one spoke again. I have been caring for my little ones so that they might not be the first victims, and this one will not listen. And there came a small voice. There will be enough for everyone. Have we forgotten the promise? How could one of us die without all of us dying? If even just one is living, then we all are living. What are we fighting over? Why have we broken and turned against each other? I don't understand. And it started again, with the long-eared ones. And it moved to the jumping ones, and into the long-legged ones, into the swimming ones. It caught the two-legged, and the hooved, and the flying. a gift. That's what it was. Someone of the long-eared had brought forth their food stash and began snuggling up to the furried one. Many were fearful. They brought forth their food stash, and they shared their space and warmth. And there was a storm, and winding, and raining, chaos. And the wind would have been right, had it not been for the mouse and the silence.
And from you, Cindy, a story?
In my correspondence with Nancy Winder, who's been one of the staff at this Holden village, I told her something that she took very seriously. I told her that part of how I see my ministry is to tell people stories where I visit, because I felt like God had given me such a wonderful opportunity to visit people where they are. It is so rare to be able to have this possibility to visit people. And so whenever I go to a particular place, I come back with something from that particular place, because I'm always gifted with something. Not a single place have I gone that the community didn't give me one gift. So when I come back with this gift, I use that gift to tell the story of the community that I have visited. And I tell it as I have seen it during the visit, with all its positive points, with all its flaws, but trying to say, what did they teach me? How did they change me? And these stories have been many, so I am going to tell one story, and I think I'll use one that I have written about in this particular book. Many of the stories of the communities that I have visited, I have written them in small books, in journals, in the journal that I edit called Women. This particular one is a story of a community that changed my whole life in Brazil in the year 1998. I went to this community as a new staff member.
Did you say 98?
1988.
Oh. It's a proleptic story.
Yes, 1988. I went to this community as a new staff of the Lutheran World Federation, just appointed, coming from a church where my gifts were limited to certain areas of church life. For example, teaching in the Sunday school was acceptable, but not even reading the scriptures in front of the church was acceptable for us that are born female. So when I arrived at this community in the church in the southern of Brazil, the pastor and the elders of the church, both men and women, called me and they said, we are delighted that you have come and that you have you will be here for the next week. We would like to ask you to preach next Sunday. And I thought to myself, preach? Are they crazy? Do they not know that I'm not, I'm a woman? And secondly, preaching is for men and they must be ordained men. I had, of course, spoken a number of times on theological subjects everywhere, so that was not the issue. And I had preached when we were only women, but not in a huge church being asked to preach. So I told the pastor, now knowing that there are many women who preach by that time, so that was not strange to me. But I told him I'm not ordained. And he said, that's delightful. Because in this community and this church, we accept that we are all the same, the clergy persons and the lay persons. And I think the whole community will be very pleased to have a sermon of a lay person as well. In fact, they have been listening to me for too long as a clergy person. So I went to myself and had some silent prayer, wondering whether I'll be committing all the sins that my church had told me that I would be committing. But I felt, okay, the church, the community, the pastor, they ask me, they would not ask me to do a wrong thing at all. And so I accepted and prepared my sermon. On the morning that I arrived to preach, they told me, it's our communion Sunday and we would like you to be an assisting minister. And I said, assisting what? Minister. Well, what do you mean exactly? I asked, and said, we want you to help with the giving of the Holy Communion. And I said, we don't do that in our church. And so I have never done it. And they said, oh, that's all right. We'll spend some time together in secrecy and we will be able to show you what happens and you will be able to do it. And I was very hesitant, very, very hesitant about it. I was not afraid to touch the holy elements because I have cleaned the utensils, I have kept things back all throughout in my church life. But I had not been an assistant minister. So, not wanting to be, I felt like I would probably be rude. I have already been put on the program and it's written there. And so I accepted to go to the service. And there the pastor of that church very gently led me through explaining how everything does and what he will when what he will do and, you know, the normal words that I was used to and what we need to do when we are giving the bread and the wine. And let me hold the bread and the wine and just imitate like I was giving it to someone else, and the cup the same. And he said, when we get there, we will see who is comfortable about giving the bread and who is comfortable about giving the wine, and ask me what I am comfortable to do for the first time. I felt a completely new person, completely like the baptism began to make a new sense to me, that once I felt like it was for the first time I was going to be together with the rest of the baptized persons, accepted as one of the people. I preached the sermon, and I preached the sermon that day really feeling the presence of God surrounding me, that every word that I said felt that was a word that the community was together with me. I looked into this community that was strange to me. Here I was, African, Latin Americans, Brazilians, speaking in English and being translated into Portuguese. And yet I didn't feel any distance. I did not feel the distance that sometimes is there when you are in a new place, with new people, with all the linguistic barriers. I cannot explain it. I cannot say it simply because I was asked to preach or was asked to help, but I felt the presence of God in such a new way. I felt that this community had given me a new baptism, a new naming, a new acceptance. I have relived this experience for many years since 1988. And joining the community of worshippers that we are now a part of in Geneva, the English-speaking Lutheran Church in Geneva, which is a welcoming community of people from many nationalities. We are presently, I'm vice president in that congregation, and we are 41 nationalities. We all come with different ways of worship, but we are invited to bring some of that worship to the table, be it in song, be it in different traditions that we come with from our home areas. So everyone is always struggling to be part of someone else's music, someone else's liturgy, someone's way, else way of carrying the Eucharist to the front or bringing the offering into the church. Very often I am asked to dance the offering as we do in Africa. And what we do in Africa, we have the offering in some places in Africa, we have the offering which is given, which is put on a basket. And we carry the basket on the head, dancing it into the church. And so very often I carry these huge pots and dance it into the church, and the rest of the community also enjoys that. But I have always felt the beginning of this participation, this freedom to participate, this releasing my spirit was the community in Brazil. And I have called it, really, they have been my mother community into a new way of being part of the church and the Christian community. That's the story I wanted to share. I have written it in this way.
Well, the story I decided to share, I have not written, but it's a story of receiving and being received, and of anticipation and letting go, and fear and grace. And it's the story of a small community wintering in deep snows in an isolated mountain valley, preparing in the darkness for the coming of the celebration of the Incarnation, lighting candles through the weeks of waiting and hope, until that time when we would receive into our midst others who came to celebrate with us the gift of love in the flesh at Christmas time. And up the hill, the snow-packed hill, came vehicles with 30-some guests, excited and full of hope and full of all of the dreams about Christmas time that stack up inside our lives over time, until the anticipation and the expectation we have coming into that season could hardly ever be met, because our memories fail us and the rough edges of Christmas pasts are softened. And with all of those hopes and expectations and softened memories came these people. And Christmas itself was lovely in its unfolding, in worship, in decorating our space for worship, in finding a tree and bringing the greens indoors and making lovely ornaments to place on the tree. And the Incarnation was present for us in the breaking of bread and the sharing of wine. But then an enormous shuddering came across the valley, which resulted in avalanches, down avalanche chutes that had not seen this kind of snow in at least 35 years. And the avalanches were so deep and so powerful that the road out of this small village in this isolated valley was cut clean off. And for the first time in the memory of the community, the members of the community decided the power of nature in these avalanches was greater than the human power we had to overcome it. And those who lived here receiving others let go of a sense of control, a false sense of control by which we'd lived all winter, and finally said, we cannot by our power open a road that these avalanches have closed. And there was great release and grace in that in that letting go. And for the first day that the roads were closed, the guests who had come to be received and celebrate with us the Incarnation felt as if they were on an unexpected holiday. They would receive an extra day of vacation, an extra day of the community, an extra day of celebration and feasting. And they received the closing of the road with really great joy. By the second day that the road was closed, in some the joy had begun to turn to anxiousness, anxiety, worry, plans that they had made had to be canceled, and yet there was no way to cancel them. They knew they could not be the places they had expected to be. But the children still were glad to be here. By the third day, some of that anxiety began to turn to real distress and fear, especially in one man who was certain he would have lost his job delivering food for a food service company, and began to imagine the specter of returning home at some point now at the close of the season to no work and to an employer who would never understand the truth, which was the power of nature was stronger than the power of human beings in this valley. By the fourth day, people had begun to run out of the prescription medication that they had very carefully counted out and brought for their time here. And they began not only to be anxious about what they were missing and what they might lose, but about their own health, about their blood pressure, about the anxiety that they were medicated for, about problems of greater. Among those who were received was a physician, a family practice physician, who also was upset at first at being trapped, who got out the PDR, the physician's desk reference, looked up the names of all these medications and made a call throughout the community for others to bring their medications. And there was a moment of great sharing when from out of the medicine cabinets and the cupboards and the drawers of people who lived here came, in fact, all of the medication that was needed for these people and carefully counted out in order to help people. One young girl missed a recital at which she was to be the soloist. It was to be taped and it was to be sent to Stanford for her music scholarship. And she had to face the letting go of that possibility, could not be retrieved. We began to learn which experiences cannot be retrieved. But one man had a problem that no one had medication for. It's a kind of prostate problem. And without his medication, he was unable to urinate. And for 5 days, he had been unable. And then for 6 days. And then he became very ill, yellow. And on the seventh day, the road opened. Or was it the eighth day? The eighth day. On the seventh day, the doctor catheterized this man, relieved him of his pain. And on the eighth day, the road opened and the people left. The man who feared he would lose his job, at one point we all watched him release. In part because our kitchen staff knew the grace of letting go of their own control. The cooks in our own kitchen released their control, their desire to do it right, to have it their way, and welcomed this man who had been in food services all of his life into the kitchen. And suddenly he had a gift to give to us, and while he feared his job was forever lost, he prepared a feast for us of chicken in a breading that he had created out of breadcrumbs. And on the eighth day, when the guests left, we feasted on a meal prepared by the man who went home to no job but traveled home with great joy that he and his gifts had been received. And his letter back to us was, "In that moment of community, I knew that the work I had was not the work God had called me to, and I have let that go too, and wait now for other labor." That's my story of receiving and being received, and letting go, and facing fear, and finally, the season of the Incarnation, knowing and receiving the presence of God in human flesh in a very isolated and snowed-in village in a valley. And Rick was among the gracious who received this man. You remember those days? And on the ninth day, I collapsed.
I think it's a stop day.
It just fell apart. Are there other stories of community or from community or knowing community that you would have to share?
In 1968, back in Kenya, I had not met Muthibi yet. Still in school. I was participating in a program that she later on was also participating in, where you go out as volunteers and stay and work with the community. And you are partly fed by the community. You sleep on the floors in classrooms. In this particular case, we went to a small community near, very close to Mount Kenya. In fact, at 4 o'clock it starts getting dark and misty and get very chilly. And the night we arrived, nobody could sleep because it was so cold that we actually made big fire in the classroom and slept, you know, just stayed around the fire. And the following morning we went to get to buy warm clothes. Anyway, that's not the story. The story is we were supposed to help the community in bringing water down from the mountain through gravity. You bring the water down and we helping constructing a water tank at a central point so that then the water can be distributed from the water tank. The different homes. These are small scale farmers. We are supposed to be there for 2.5 weeks. The first 4 days. Normally, if you are involved in leadership, you go there about 3 days early. So, two of us had gone there 2 days. 3 days earlier, actually. And we realized there was a serious problem because every farmer, you see, to bring the pipeline, every farmer wanted the pipeline to go like this. You know, they are different plots. The effect of that was, first of all, you are going to reduce the power of the gravity because you start interfering with it. Mm-hmm. Secondly, it was going to become very expensive because the main pipe has to be a big pipe, but they have to flow pipes. So you'll be using a main pipe, which was bigger, to try to reach the individual holdings. So for the first 3 days, actually, we could arrive at a conclusion. The other volunteers arrived, there were 30 of them, and we had volunteers from Europe, about 10 of them, and 20 were from Kenya. We stayed for another 4 days, still doing nothing. And in the meantime, we are trying to negotiate behind the scenes and negotiate with the administration, with the chief. The community had no faith in the chief, the administration. So on the fourth day, the volunteers now started getting very agitated because, you see, you came to do an assignment. And they have traveled miles, they have paid for themselves to come to this place, but they are doing nothing. So finally we decided to handle the problem directly with the heads of the heads of the different families. The first meeting was not successful. Then we had a separate meeting with the women, the wives of the families. Then we got, they gave us the key. They gave us the strategy. But you see, that can't work, you know, until the men had actually approved. So then we had a separate meeting with the men. And after arguing for several hours, we finally agreed on the line through what would come down. So after 6 days, we actually now started working. We dug the trench. We helped to lay the pipes because we are working together with them. And we finished the water tank by the time we left. Now, what was the key was, what was important, the day we were leaving, we were surprised they held a big feast. And they invited people from other villages. And the project itself ceased. They ceased seeing it, the project as a water project, but as the reconciliation project. It had helped bring reconciliation among the different families, and it became a symbol. And in fact, soon after we left, they sent an application. Other villages sent an application for us to come back. But you see, we are not experts, because we have to have missions from them. All we had was our hands and our labor. That water scheme became a symbol in more ways than one. Politically, this group used to be very divided. They now saw things from a common perspective. For me, personally, it had a side that became very, very personal. The head, the most difficult person, you know, the one who the biggest agitator against a pipe which was not going to serve, and he happened to be one of the leaders. So in that big public gathering, he said the only way he could, I was still in school, I was a young man, the only way he could thank me was to give me his daughter in marriage. For me, this took me by, you know, I was just like this. First of all, that was never anywhere on my agenda. I still had And true enough, you know, he had discussed with his wife and they had discussed with their daughter and they had been agreed. Now,
no.
I didn't even know how to respond. I was saved by the person who was the director of the program. I was a volunteer myself, but I was a full-time. He was very experienced, Musibi knows him. He laughed over it, and then instead of the daughter in marriage, you know, I was given a heifer.
A heifer?
Yes. And
give him a chance to wait for me.
So I asked the family, then I told them, you see, because I come from very far,
sure.
You look after the heifer.
Are you going to have a program here?
For me.
8:30?
Yeah. Yeah, we just started, it's still going on. You're welcome. You look after her heifer for me. And, you know, I will come back sometime later to collect it. And he kept writing. About 3 years later, we went there because in the organization, somebody from there now, because they had done so well, have been elected to represent that group to sit on the national board. So 3 years we went back there. And you know, the heifer had already given birth toys. And I had milk for the heifer. Now, what happened was this particular group became like a model group. And for me, personally, it transformed my faith in working with the communities. Was really, it is then that I felt energized. And I probably took more from that community than what we gave them. Because even the work that I do today, I have had many diversions, like studying finance and accounts and economics, but all that knowledge goes back to working with communities.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the heifer and the two people, are they still there?
I find that they understood the message when I asked them to look after it for me. You know, I basically was saying I'm very grateful for it. You continue being mine, you continue benefiting from it. Because it was very far away from home,
right,
where I come from. And it would have cost a fortune to try to transport it. Yeah.
Would the daughter have had any say in this agreement?
I don't know. She appeared very happy and was very disappointed that I wasn't, you know, and I had to say, look, it hasn't, I had to explain to her, it has nothing to do with her personally. But, you know, I simply wasn't ready. And probably even if I were, maybe I would prefer a different mechanism of looking for a bride. Although that was normal, you know, in our own situation, it's normal for people to talk and say we think so and so is good for you. You know, that is, it's not outrageous. So I wasn't, that it happened, I was surprised. That it does happen, that did not surprise me.
Oh, why? We're telling stories of community, stories that come up out of our experiences of community or stories about certain communities. And we've heard four, and we have time to hear at least another one, or maybe two if they're brief, for closing time. Barbara, you said you could have one if you...
If I could decide which one.
Yeah, that's the problem, isn't it? It's like...
I think I can tell one briefly.
Okay.
When I lived in South Bend, I belonged in the Mennonite congregation because Lutherans in South Bend don't have cars. they must not have, because I called up the churches and asked for a ride to a Lutheran worship service, and nobody ever gave me a ride. And the Mennonites always called me up and asked if I wanted a ride, so I went. After about 4 weeks of going to the Mennonite church because I couldn't get a ride to a Lutheran church, I was there for worship one day, and they always have this sharing time, and I had a singing engagement, so I asked for prayers. I said, I don't even belong here, but I need prayers, and you're the only people I know in South Bend. So they prayed, they asked me for specifics after the worship service. About a dozen people asked me for specifics, what to pray for. And the next week, the same dozen asked me how it went. I thought that was pretty phenomenal. So I kept going to that Mennonite church. Never did get a ride to a Lutheran church, but after about a year of really liking the worship there and growing in the community and seeing how they discerned the Spirit and made their decisions by consensus, I was having a great deal of trouble in my doctoral program, and so I wasn't sure whether to continue. So I said to the Mennonite pastor one day, could you please pray for me? I am not quite sure whether to keep on with this PhD program. And he said, well, I'll call a meeting to discern the Spirit. I didn't know what that was. But one evening, about this many people sat in a living room, and they said, well, what's your problem? And I said, well, I was having a really hard time. Some professors were giving me a bad time because I was too conservative about the Bible. And I was having a bad time health-wise. A bunch of things were going wrong with my health, and it just didn't seem like I should stay there, but I didn't want to make that decision too fast. And they started asking me questions. And one person would ask this, and then there'd be some silence, and then we'd pray a while, and then somebody else would ask something, and it seemed to sort of funnel. And all of a sudden, one of the women who was also doing a PhD said, well, how do you view your life? And I said, I've always been a bridge. I've always bridged between scholars and lay people, between Missouri Synod and other Lutherans, between old and young. I've always been sort of a bridge, but especially kind of a bridge between scholars and lay people. She said, well, a bridge needs to have a firm foundation on both sides. And that was the first time ever in making a decision that a light bulb went on, that it just all of a sudden was clear as a bell. She said, you're firmly founded on the lay people's side. How firmly founded are you on the scholar's side? And so I knew I had to continue. And that knowledge held me for years of struggle. So I decided I would never make a major decision alone again. So on January 15th, 1989, Myron Sandberg proposed, and I said, let's call a meeting to discern the Spirit. So we spent 2 weeks in that meeting, asking people and getting letters, and we purposely asked two people we thought would be against it. And one of the men was against it because he had told me that as a freelancer, I should always stay single so I could travel wherever God called me. And I asked him to pray about it and give us what he thought God was saying, and ask other people to ask us questions. And we got letters, and every single person we asked said, we really see God leading you two together to marriage. And this man who had told me I should never marry but stay single said, I have prayed about it and God has changed my mind. And I think Myron is extremely good for you and would be such a support that it would deepen your ministry, and I really think that you should marry. And one of the fellows that I thought would say no was a fellow I was also dating who had teased one time that if Myron ever proposed, he wanted a chance to make a counterproposal. So I wrote him and said, I know you were just kidding, but I'd like your opinion anyway. And he called me up and said, you know, I've thought about it, and I really think Myron is better for you than I am. And I hope you'll invite me to the wedding, and I hope we'll always be friends. And yeah, I think it's a really good thing. So at our wedding, we did another Mennonite thing and asked people to share how our marriage affected their spiritual lives. Mm-hmm. And people stood up and said, you know, I was asked as part of this process, and I'm really invested in this marriage. And I will really support you and pray for you and continue and care for you. So everywhere I go, I tell young people that. Don't make major decisions without a meeting to discern the Spirit. And I thought young people would tell me I was crazy. And instead they tell me, I don't have that kind of community. Great openings and great insights, but also a real sadness that our churches are not that kind of community. So maybe if I tell that story, you all can be agents of discerning the Spirit for young people in your community.
You live in Portland, right? Or Vancouver?
I live in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. Do they have a Mennonite church there?
No.
I was...
There's a Mennonite church in Portland.
Is there?
Yeah.
I live in Seattle, and I was a trip up to Winnipeg a few weeks ago, and that's all they had up there.
Yeah.
But yeah. I was really impressed by the service they had, and they had a communion there, and they had a choir loft here, and then they had a window. You could see the immersion. I've never seen one of those before. But I think our communions are just as good. That's a matter of opinion, I guess.
I'd like to share a story. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
It's about a guy named Ray.
It's about what?
Named Ray. I had been asked to start a congregation in Portland, Maine. And when I got there, I discovered that a lot of people were against the church, that it was very much focused on New Age stuff. And so after watching and listening for a while, I realized that probably to call it a church would be a mistake. So after having met with a nun and some people who were interested in starting this church, the question came up, why was it the nun had asked a bunch of Lutherans to start a congregation in her neighborhood where she was the administrator for a hospital? And she said, because Christ is not. And the question was, not what? Christ is not a living presence. And so when it came time to start thinking about what do I call this thing to be, like birthing a baby before it's born, it was tentative, and I said a name might be Community of the Living Presence. And so I started knocking on doors, and I discovered that people who were most drawn, well, it was an inner city, very, very poor situation. Over 75% of the people were under 25 years old and were women with children. And so very quickly I ended up working with people on the street, because anyone that poor is in and out of housing and onto the street. And of course there were the winos. One day as I was walking down the street, these two cronies were kind of hugging a brown paper bag mutually and weaving on the sidewalk straight toward me. And the older one knew me, and his name was Ray, so Ray introduced me to Ray, the other one. And Ray immediately proposed to me. That's what started me off on which story to tell. And I said, well, Ray, we'll talk about it some other time. He remembered that. And one night, after Ray had been kind of around the edges, he showed up at my doorstep proposing again. Again, half drunk. And so I said, Ray, not when you're drunk. Let's talk about this when you're sober. So he went home. And at 1:30 in the morning, I received a phone call from Ray. Would I come over? He wanted to invite the Lord into his life. And I thought, sure. It's something like, come over and look at my etchings. But I went because I heard something in him that was sober. And I knocked on the door, and it was a typical flop house where someone watches the door and you have to be able to convince them to let you in. And then I was told to go upstairs to the kitchen on the second floor, that was the common place that non-members of that place could meet with others. And so here was Ray and me, sitting in the dark because the light burned out about 3 minutes after the discussion started, Sherry started. And indeed, here was a mass of humanity come to himself and recognizing he needed God. He bawled like a baby. And I want to say before I go any further that I have gotten his permission to share what I'm about to share. He started telling me his life story. He had been a transvestite, bisexual, a prostitute to both men and women. That's how he got his money. Plus theft, okay? And he hated himself. He had been in the Merchant Marine. He had gone to Annapolis. He had been kicked out because of his drinking, and now he had slowly spiraled downward to Portland, Maine. He even tried to kill himself several times. And in between his tears of remorse, and he started laughing and shared that the last time he tried it, he went out in the middle of the winter time when it was below zero, and he stripped off all his clothes and got into a tree so that he could die of exposure. And wouldn't you know, someone still found him. He said, I just can't die right. And I said, that's because God wants you to live right. And that night, that man became a Christian in a way that he had never been one before. So the next time I saw him, he proposed to me again, sober. And I said, Ray, let's see how you work. So he started coming to church, and Ray played the piano like you couldn't believe. And he was our gift. He played any hymn that would come along, and he knew many that we didn't, and he taught them to us. And we'd sing into the night. And then one day, Ray said to me, Carol Lee, I want to become a baptized member. I want to become a Christian for real, real. And so we all gathered around him. People who had fed him, cried with him, been in prison with him, fought with him, drank with him. And we baptized him good. About a day later, Ray came to me and he said, you know, Carol Lee, I've lied to a lot of judges. One in particular, I need to go back to that judge and tell him all the things that I lied myself out of so I wouldn't go to jail. And I said, yes, God could do that, could see him doing that. That would be a good thing, but was he aware of what would happen? Oh, yeah. He said, can everybody get together with me and pray with me? And so we all got together that night and we prayed with Ray, over Ray, our hands on his head and shoulders. And the next day I went with him and the judge made him sit all day long. He was the very last case at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And Ray got 6 months in prison. And so I handed Ray a Bible and I told him, I said, you know, you're lucky. You get 6 months of doing nothing but reading the word. And our community supported him, Ray, with letters. And he wrote back sometimes. When Ray got out, the first thing he did was get drunk and lie about it. But he was back with us, in and out. He finally disappeared. I heard the story two ways. One was that he stole a car, and the other one was that his roommate stole a car, and he just happened to ride with him all the way out to Vancouver, Washington. And then I didn't hear any more about Ray. Until about 3 years ago. And I have a picture of Ray with a cast on his arm on the day of his marriage. It seems that he picked a fight with the guy who spoke a bad word about his bride. But Ray is now a member of a Lutheran congregation. He sits on a church council. He is a longshoreman. He works the fishing boats. And he has a baby. And that's the story of Ray. Who wouldn't have been alive if it hadn't been for all the people and that little thing called community of living presence.
Our commitment at the forums is to close in an hour. We certainly haven't heard every story that could be told in this room, but we have been blessed by the ones that have been shared. And night has gathered now like a wide dark skirt around us, and we hear the sound of hymns coming from the hotel to remind us of the living presence of Christ among us. So we commit our bodies and our souls and all that we are into the keeping of God for the night. We pray that God's holy angels would have charge over us, that the wicked one would have no power in us. Blessed sleep, blessed community, be with you. Amen.